right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to...
I'm going to be quiet.
Tarver's going to be quiet. I mean, I knew that was going to happen. You all that have just finished hearing the theme song, you all knew that was going to happen. Guys, we got Tarver King in the house tonight. Nate Whiting could not be with us because it is currently Charleston Wine and Food, which means he is getting his ass beat right now. The restaurant I work at does not participate in Charleston Wine and Food, so life is an idyllic wonderland. I'm not going to lie. Like, Tarver and I have had a lot of good times at Charleston Wine and Food. A lot of great events at Charleston Wine and Food. I have come to really dislike Charleston Wine and Food.
You've mentioned that before. Like, it sounds like they've kind of turned a page.
I'm not even sure if they turned or if I just realized that it never really benefits the restaurant much.
Yeah.
Like, it's just... Like, if you do an event at your restaurant... You don't make as much money as if you would have been open during Wine and Food. Because, like, you get packed out during Wine and Food because the city's full of people that are into food. So restaurants that have decent food get packed out. They go crazy. And if you do an event, you don't really do a turn because it's just one seating. So, and then you gotta...
Isn't that mystery ingredient dinner we did part of Charleston Food and Wine? Is it Food and Wine or Wine and Food?
It's Wine and Food. I think it always has been. I'm not sure. Yeah, we did a mystery ingredient dinner for them.
That was fun.
That was super cool. That was a long time ago. I mean, I used to love the gospel brunches that we did with Woodlands. Those were great.
Yeah.
I mean, I did two of them, but they were great. And then, like...
What was our mystery ingredient for that dinner? Was it bone marrow?
Man, I don't remember. I don't have any recollection. I remember going and getting wings with you after, but just barely.
I remember something after that event was over. You had a personal vendetta against me. You, like, we were standing outside and you were like, let's chug beers. Let's see who wins. Right. I was in shock and awe at how fast you not even like drank a beer, swallowed a beer in a gulp. You're like, I got you. I was like, dude.
Well, I mean, okay, so for those of you following along at home, Tarver and I have long had a rivalry over who can drink a beer the fastest, and we can both drink a beer really, really fast.
Quite quickly.
I remember the first time I ever chugged a beer in front of Tarver. I'd been at the Woodlands for maybe like 3 months, and I edged him by like a fraction of a second, and like he went all quiet, and I was just like, I'm a new guy, I'm having fun, I got a beer, I got another beer. And he comes up to me and he goes, are you like fast? And I was like, yeah, I'm really fast. He goes, okay, good, because not a lot of people beat me. Yeah, if you ever need a couple of 12-ounce beers just gone in a hurry, Tarver and I are your guys.
Quick, drink these beers. They're gone.
Nobody worry. The beer thing has been organized. But yeah, all these, I've had some great times at Charleston Wine and Food, but it's turned into a grind. And like at social, we would always do a lunch, and the lunch was great because we'd make some money on the lunch. We're not open for lunch. So I'd have a hell of a long couple of days, but that's okay. I'm a chef during Wine and Food. You're used to getting killed. I mean, this is part of the job, but like we do lunch and it'd be really good. And then we do dinner and we'd just be nuts because it's wine and food, and that'd be it. It'd be a good weekend. But if you do an event during the PM side, like instead of regular service, you almost invariably make less money than you would have if you just threw the doors open and just did a crusher service. And even worse than that is the Culinary Village, where it's like you're outdoors, maybe under a tent on a little card table, serving up little morsels to people that are lining up and paying you with tickets or something. Like, it's...
What, really?
I don't even remember. No, maybe they don't pay a ticket. Maybe it's when you're in there, everything's free. Maybe I'm confusing it with Taste of Charleston, which is another thing I'm not a big fan of.
That's kind of similar. Like, I think, we used to, around our area, we did something like Restaurant Week, where, like, restaurants would do, like, a super cheap three-course meal.
If you can,
we never participated because it seemed like just a fucking dumb idea.
Depending on the restaurant, you can really make it work for you. Like, there's a right and a wrong way to participate in Restaurant Week. Yeah. Restaurant Week was really cool for social because it was like three courses for $30. And honestly, yeah, at social, that was a little bit more than our normal price point, but nobody ever got three courses. So that was a way for us to get an app and a dessert out to everybody instead of just one plate. So like, it was ideal for social. It would be a great week for us. We'd do a ton of sales. And for me, it was an excuse to do a menu that was about half new. And then after Restaurant Week was over, the dishes that worked, I just keep. And that was like, that was twice a year. I would allow me to sort of shake the Etch-A-Sketch on the menu. And that was when I did my reprints. You know, it was a wine bar, so we couldn't afford to be like ultra seasonal and change the menu all the time. But that was my opportunity to try out five or six new dishes at the same time. And then usually of the five or six that you're doing for Restaurant Week, two or three would be like good enough to just keep on the menu. Like, okay, we're going to 86 that and that. We'll keep these and these. That was awesome. Yeah. But ultimately, the more places started doing Restaurant Week, the more of a drag it became, because it used to be that if you were doing Restaurant Week, that was the draw. You were going to fill up. But when every restaurant in town's doing Restaurant Week, like, they want, everybody wants to get in on the fun. And the thing is, it's like,
where was the profit? I mean, like, it's like, if every restaurant's doing it, it's expanding into such a saturated thing. Like, well, where
the profit,
was there some sort
Charleston,
of like
the South Carolina Restaurant Association organized it, and they got a cut. So it was in their best interests to make it spread. And this is, I'm pretty sure this is how this all worked. This all happened a little bit above my pay grade, but you had to pay a fee to be in their promotional materials, to be on the website. You paid them. So it was in their best interest to make sure everybody did it. But once everybody does it, it doesn't matter that anybody's doing it. And it was like all that stuff, Wine and Food, Restaurant Week, ultimately all that really benefits the people that put it on. Yeah. And ultimately the restaurants, Wine and Food, for the most part, the best way to be a restaurant during Wine and Food and make money is to not really participate, but just be there and be open and serve cool specials that weekend. That's the way you do it.
I see.
And I see these restaurants just breaking themselves in half. And like, then there was also the fact that for a while there, it really started to become the Top Chef Festival. Like, in the beginning, it was the Food Network Festival. They really seemed to have, like, they wanted to have all these guys from the Food Network. But then after that, it became Chef Testants. And Top Chef really sort of muddled the culture of American cuisine for a while.
Do you remember when they asked us to do it when I was at Woodlands all those years ago? It was like one of the first seasons of Top Chef, and they're like, hey, we want you to be a contestant. And I think it was you and Nate, or I know I got asked to be on Top Chef, or maybe I'm thinking of Chopped, because I got asked to be on that too.
I auditioned for Chopped.
I could see you'd be really good on that show.
No. Here's my thing about Chopped. I'm glad I didn't.
I'm glad you didn't too, but I could see you doing really well.
Ultimately,
I could see you being like a really good like personality to watch.
They wanted me to look in the camera and say something really like, they're like, tell me how you're going to win. And I was like, I was like, I don't make any illusions that I'm going to win. I just want to go out there and play hard. I want to show out. Like, if I win, I win. I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about having fun and looking good. And they were like, nah, man, you gotta say how you're gonna win. And I was like, that's not me. That's not something I'd say. And the guy's like, this is what the producers are looking for. And I was like, well, then I don't think the producers are looking for me. And what I wanted to say was, all those D-bag things that people say on the air, like where they're like, I'm gonna bring it home. I'm gonna take that $10,000 and I'm gonna win it for my family. All that goofy stuff that they say, you made them say that.
Yeah,
I've always rolled my eyes when people say that, and now I just feel sorry for them.
Yeah,
like it's all sham.
But viewers, the majority, the mass amount of viewers that watch that show eat it up.
But you know, then, the thing I like about Chopped is that it's a fair contest, right? Like, you get a basket and it's full of crazy stuff, but it's the same basket that's full of crazy stuff that the guy next to you gets. So fair's fair. Yeah. You're both like, oh, okay, cream cheese, smoked trout, and Fruit Loops. Shit. Yeah. That's you know, that's rough. But like, a chef that I was contemporaries with that I know personally went on as well, like with me, to audition. and he ended up getting on, and he was on their April Fool's episode, and they were messing with him the entire time. They were like turning off the deep fryer, and they put you know, a pack of peas in their bag, and the peas were actually like rolled fondant, dyed green and rolled up to look like peas. So when they broke them out, it was fondant. Like, and all of a sudden, it stops being a fair contest. It's like, yeah. I don't want to go on there and face flop because you guys got jokes. Like, yeah. That's, I'm not a prideful person. If I go out there and I look like an absolute jerk on my merits, I am perfectly at peace with that. I got that. I'm so glad I didn't go on that show.
Yeah, I agree. I'm glad you did. I'm glad you didn't do. I remember when they were asking, I think it was you and Nate, they were both like, he might want to watch an episode of that before you say yes. I think it was.
I feel like it was Top Chef. I think I remember this.
It was Top Chef. And I remember seeing like an episode on YouTube or something that they had to like get ingredients out of a snack machine.
Yeah, yeah, that was Top Chef. And the thing is, if you would have said Chopped back then, I would have told you to go on, because that was before I learned how they manipulate you. That was back when I was just like, oh, yeah, it's a fun show. It's stupid, but it's awesome. Like, you got to make crazy food with crazy ingredients, and it's ridiculous what they give you, but they give the next guy the same thing. That's pretty rad. I had not yet developed my distaste for it. Whereas Top Chef, I was like, nah, man, they're going for human drama. It's not about food.
Oh yeah, it's just drama. And like, I think it was the second season after that, I was like one of the judges. They had like this outdoor cooking thing. It was at Ayrshire Farm, which is up near here. And all the contestants were out cooking out in the field it was like outside, but it was still like gas stoves and stuff. And it was, and I wasn't like on a panel of like three people. It was like 20 people. It was a lot of people. And we all tried all their food, and we were like all judges and shit. And I just remember watching all those contestants and all those people and just being like, man, like you can see the fear in their eyes, and also just kind of like a feeling of being, maybe it was just assumption on my part, but it just kind of seemed like they were deflated. And I just remember saying like, that's just not cooking. It's not, there's no romantic, it's not romantic. There's no meaning behind it. It's just trying to make good TV. I guess it's fun to watch for a lot of people, but like, there's no way I could ever be on any of that stuff.
I have come to really kind of believe that competitive cooking is not where it's at. I'm not into the Bocuse d'Or. I'm not into the Culinary Olympics.
Iron Chef used to be fun to watch. Is that still on?
Iron Chef was fun in like a trippy kind of way. That's another one that, things are not what they seem. Like,
dude, like the things they're pulling out in like quote unquote an hour, like there's no way.
Right. I won't reveal who I know or how I know this, because I don't want to get anybody in trouble, but I knew someone that was with a restaurant that was on, and they said that they went and they had five ingredients. They were told it was going to be one of five, and they drilled on those five different menus. So they had a menu plan for each of five ingredients. So it's not spontaneous.
I assumed it was something like that. It's just like some of the things they were making, they just had to have known what it was going to be.
An hour. I've spent an hour and all I did was chop onions and boil and peel eggs. Like, it's cooking takes time. Like, an hour is nuts. An hour is nuts.
And like the Iron Chef's like Morimoto, dude, I got to eat at his restaurant. I have his cookbook. That dude is a fucking badass.
Yeah.
I got to eat at his, when he first, he opened his restaurant in Philadelphia. It was just like a little sushi bar. We got the omakase there, and it was fucking bomb. It was, and he was there on the line fucking, or, you know, at the sushi bar fucking cooking. And I was
I'm not, of all of them, Iron Chef is the one that bugs me the least, especially the Japanese one, because it's kind of like, it's kind of divorced from
the American one. Yeah.
Our culture. Like, once you get into the American one and like, you get into a situation where like you occasionally you'll see somebody that you know up there, and it's just weird. It just takes me right out of the fun. I mean, how many times have you seen someone you're acquainted with on Iron Chef? It's always weird, isn't it?
Yeah. And like the American one, I only watched like one or two episodes of the American one of the first season. And I think William Shatner was like one of the.
Oh, that was the first attempt. That only lasted a couple episodes. They redid it a little later, and it was way better. But still,
because it was fucking hard to watch, man. I love William Shatner. Don't get me wrong, but he was just like, the sea urchin is—they're serving the gonads of the sea urchin. Like,
Yeah, I mean, they went and got Shatner because they wanted it to be the biggest freak show possible. And I guess I kind of understand where they're coming from. I mean, that's funny. But, you know, it's, I don't know. Like, it's just, culinary competition is just not something I'm into. You know what I really can't stand? That the one where Flay goes out there and takes people on at their own thing.
Fuck Bobby Flay, man.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that show. Like, when he goes, like, to other restaurants.
It's called Throwdown. And he, like, goes to places that are known for one thing, like fried chicken. Or they went to Peninsula Grill and did coconut cake, because Peninsula Grill is famous for coconut cake.
Yeah, like, I remember it.
They do whatever they do. Like, Bobby Flay takes on the hometown hero at whatever they're good at and sees if he can beat him. And that bugs me for two reasons. One, I just think it's kind of mean-spirited. Like, I like shows where they go to, like, a restaurant and just sort of hype what they're about. I mean, like, in principle, I like Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. I'm not a big Guy Fieri fan.
Guy Fieri sucks.
I gotta admit. But the idea of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives is cool. Go into little blue-collar hole-in-the-wall restaurants and just putting them on blast. That's great. Take these people and just give them some exposure. Let people flow in there. Let people be like, I heard that place has sick meatloaf. Let's all go there. Like,
it's supporting people.
It's cheerleading. You should be like, restaurant media should either be a serious critic writing serious, fair reviews, or documentary just showing unvarnished what it's like for people that are interested in what guys like us go through on our day to day. Or fun cheerleading. It should never be about tearing them down. It should never be about putting people on the spot. I just think culinary competition is dumb. It's not competitive. It's like competitive music. Like, when a bunch of people sit around and argue over who's the best guitar player of all time. Like, you're wasting your time. Somebody's like, I think it's Van Halen. And the other guy's like, no, it's Hendrix. And like, if you got those two guys in a room, they wouldn't argue over who's better. They'd compare tricks.
Yeah.
They'd be like, let's jam.
Yeah, me and a buddy, Steve Forte, have been arguing for years over who's a better drummer, Neil Peart. Obviously, I like Neil Peart. Who's his guy? Who's a drummer for The Who?
Keith Moon.
Keith Moon, yeah.
I think the answer is that
Neil Peart is by far one of the greatest technical drummers of all time. I don't even care.
I mean, my thought on that one is that they're you're comparing apples and oranges. Like,
I agree.
It's Neil Peart is very much a technical drummer. If you were going to compare him to anybody, maybe the guy from Dream Theater, like,
Jesus, yeah.
You know, that he's that kind of drummer. Whereas Keith Moon was super important because he was one of the first guys that just invented beating the shit out of your kit.
Yeah,
like, he was the first guy who was like, I'm gonna fill, but every single hit on this fill, I'm gonna hit as hard as I can, and it's just gonna be a bunch of eighth notes on the toms, or 16th notes on the toms. But I'm going to be bashing my kid up like my life depended on it. And like,
you know who's a fucking awesome drummer? And not to get off completely off subject. We were on a good roll there.
It's hot dogs and caviar. We don't need subjects. We just talk about whatever.
I am not the biggest Slipknot fan. I've enjoyed some of their songs, but like, their drummer is one of the best drummers I've ever seen in my life.
I'll check it out.
I don't know. I can't remember his name, but you should like just check him out.
I will.
Solely. Wow. Like, that dude's extremely good.
My whole point is that, like, comparing Keith Moon to Neil Peart is like comparing Eric Repair to Grant Achatz. They're doing different things. And you can't compare, or it's like, what's a better movie, Mad Max Fury Road or Thoroughbreds? Like, they are both two of my very favorite movies. One is a tense, atmospheric, psychological thriller, and the other is an insane car chase on acid. You can't pick which one is better. One is about emotionless, spoiled teenagers in the Hamptons, and the other is about a bunch of mutant Hot Wheels cars that like Rancid is riding, and like you can't compare them. So, and culinary competition is like
another example of two things. Like I just don't like Bobby Flay for a lot of reasons. I mean, and I used to have. I had his first cookbook when I was first started cooking. I mean, in the 90s, you know, I used to think he was fucking cool. He came from like a rough background. You know, he was a troublemaking kid and made it work through cooking and stuff. Like, I respected that.
Right. And you and I wouldn't know anything about that
at all. Yeah. That's weird. But like, you know, a show like that where he goes town to town, like taking on, you know, people that are known for something. That's just that's why, like, I mean, what's that Great British Bake Off show? What's it called?
Great British Bake Off?
Yeah. Did I say it right? Yeah.
Yeah. I've never watched it, but.
It just makes you feel good, man. Like, people fuck up, you know, people make mistakes and stuff, and you're not going to learn a whole lot off of what they're doing here, you know, but like, it just, like, if you want to just zone the fuck out and you don't want to, like, you know, you just, like, it's raining and you don't want to care. You just want to feel good. Like, that's just something.
Okay. You make a good point. Like, the type of culinary competition, like turning in your pie at the fair, where it really is kind of fun for everybody. That's cool.
It's fun for everybody. Even if it sucks and they tell you it sucks, you're like, I'll try again next year. Yeah. You know, and everybody's like, way to go for entering, you know, like, good job for trying, you know, like, you know, that kind of thing. I like that.
I think I need to watch more British Bake Off, but
you should try it, dude.
Since you mentioned Bobby Flay, I have, first off, an admission to make.
You did.
Okay. Since we are talking about Bobby Flay, Tarver, I have both a personal admission to make and a pivot into another topic that we have previously discussed going into this evening.
Okay.
The personal admission is I went out to Vegas a couple of years ago and went to a whole bunch of restaurants. The centerpiece of the weekend was Robuchon. I may have mentioned that. It ruled. But we went to, I think, approximately 40 other restaurants over like 5 days. I may be exaggerating. Wow. I'm lying. It wasn't that many, but it was a lot. Like, it was crazy. Like 3 meals a day in, maybe not three, but like, it was nuts. We spent money like it was water. It was crazy. But one of the places that we went, we actually checked out a Bobby Flay Mesa Grill that was in one of the casinos. I went in there looking for a fight. I was totally ready to just rip it all apart, because not only was it a Bobby Flay restaurant, but it was like a franchise Bobby Flay restaurant, like, you know, a satellite Bobby. I don't know that it was a franchise. I have no idea.
Low hanging fruit, everyone. Let's get some.
This is like, you know, the and you know, D wanted to go in there. She's like, hey, let's go in here. You've never been to a Bobby Flay place. And I was like, yeah, you're right. I've never been to a Bobby Flay place.
Yeah.
He's like, you talk bad shit. Let's actually check it out. Then I went in there, and you know what? Food was really, really good.
Really?
Yeah.
I trust you. I mean, there's a reason why there's a franchise. There's a reason why there's tons of them everywhere.
It was executed well, and it wasn't just the same old stuff. It wasn't, it wasn't boring. It was like Chicago 3-star food. It wasn't trying to be ultra fine dining. It was trying to be like casual fine dining. But as far as casual fine dining goes, everything was really nice. Everything was executed well. Everything was seasoned well. All the techniques were executed properly. The flavors, I mean, yeah, there was a lot of chilies on stuff, but I mean, that's complaining about that Bobby Flay has too many dishes that have chilies in them is like complaining that 101 Dalmatians has too many dogs in it. Like, it's, you're gonna get chilies, but it was really, really good. Not something I'd seek out, just because, like, Southwestern fine dining isn't really my go-to. Like, if I'm gonna get Latin American flavors, I want them in an extremely authentic, highly inexpensive, and probably pretty grungy environment. You know, that's really where I like.
It's a risky bet to try and get like the fusion version of that, where it's like more American, you know, friendly.
Yeah, it's. I'd rather just have gnarly, hole in the wall Mexican food 10 out of 10 times, or go to some Caribbean restaurant that's owned by some dude that's from there and is just doing his home style stuff, you know, some guy from El Salvador.
Like, yeah, there's a place called Maria's here in Winchester, and it was like apologetically authentic Mexican cooking. Like, and we walked in, and like, you know, there wasn't like nachos and shit like that. Like, and the owner, Maria, who was the server, and her husband was a chef, like, came out and was like, apologetically, like, you know, we don't have, you know, the things you might see in like most Mexican restaurants. And we were like, no, that's fucking awesome. And it was so fucking good. It was so good. And then kept going, moved away from Winchester, came back like a couple years later, and it was completely different. It was like something sold out. I don't know what happened, and like, it became like everyday Mexican restaurant food, and now the restaurant's closed. But that's not even what I want to talk about. Like, I went to Vegas. When did you go to Vegas?
2 years ago.
Oh, when I went to Vegas, it was for Nate Shapiro's bachelor party. But we did some cool shit, like non-restaurant related, you know, like we went skydiving, did a bunch of cool shit. But we ate at Pierre Gagnaire's restaurant. We ate at Guy Savoy's restaurant.
Hell yes.
Yeah, we ate at a few other ones, but there was a restaurant called Roku, which
went to Roku.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
We were at Robichon, and they were like, you know, what else is, they were just chatting with us, and I was like, I have one question.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, we want to get off the strip. Like, we're restaurant people. I had to get D's mom, not so much. It was me and D and D's mom. I was like, we're restaurant people, longtime restaurant people, good fine dining resume, and the strip's great, and we're having a great time. But where can we go that's off the strip? Where do restaurant people go on their day off?
This is the exact same conversation I had. I had a buddy, a chef at goddamn, his name's Uday Huja. What the fuck was he? He was the chef. I'll think of it in a second. Anyway, but I called him and I was like, hey man, we're coming to Vegas. Where do you go to eat? Like, where do like other chefs and cooks go to eat? And he's like, you got to go to fucking Roku. It sounds like the same thing that you were just having. So fucking good. I remember we had calf liver raw, and like it was just like thin slices with like tracing paper thin shavings of garlic and top shelf sesame oil and salt, and fuck, that was good. We had pork belly that was and anyway, we got a tour of the kitchen. I don't know if you got to see the kitchen.
No, we didn't.
It's a shoebox, and all they had was like one yakitori grill with like tin foil and just hardwood charcoal. And like, we walked in there and I don't think the chef even knew that we were coming back. And I was like, hey man, like, I just want to check out the kitchen. It's like, how's it going? You know, it's kind of shit. And he was basically like a face of like, hey, this is our kitchen, but you can see behind his eyes, he's like, get the fuck out of here, man. Like,
you are in my way and slowing me down.
Yeah. Yeah, I picked up on it real quick. I was like, I just want to check out the kitchen. Have a good night.
Yeah. No, I it was the same thing. I said, and the guy's like, you know what? Let me go ask the cooks where they go. And he went back to the back, and then he came back and told us about Roku. Went there the next night. Oh, man. The tempura ice fish. Did you try that?
That was not on when I was there. I had their homemade tofu. That was fucking bomb.
Yeah, that was nuts. Dude, I don't remember everything we had because it was the middle of a whirlwind a weekend. But man.
I remember this. I remember we had squid that was cooked over coals. And they had this sake called like dragon something. That was fucking awesome.
I wasn't drinking sake. I think I just had like a lot of Asahi beer.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like,
that's a good beer.
Like seven. Like, we were there for a while.
That's awesome.
And Dee's mom's like, this place is so good. She wouldn't eat anything raw. And so we just explained that. We were like, we want raw stuff. She won't eat anything raw. Don't worry. We got it. There's more than enough to go around. And we just crushed it. It was what an insanely good restaurant. Maybe the best Japanese restaurant I've ever been to.
Yeah, it was real, real good. It was real, real good.
How crazy is it that like we both went to Vegas like years apart from one another and ended up getting sent to the exact same restaurant for the exact same reason? That is awesome. Yeah, all right, well, I will put a link up to Sushi Roku in the podcast companion, because if you go to Vegas, first off, you got to get off the strip. You got to get off the strip. The strip will rot your brain. Like, the strip
will also rob your wallet, dude. Guy Savoy's restaurant was God damn, that was expensive, man.
I went to Robichon, Crimea River.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It was nuts.
Did you get a potato puree?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Was it? I've never had it.
The potato puree that you and Nate taught me is better.
No, but they use like those, what are the Lorette potatoes? That's what one of the things they're famous for.
I'm telling you, the potato puree that you and Nate taught me is a little bit better. However, I also recognize that it's next to impossible to make more than like 2/3 of a 6-pan of the potato puree that you and Nate taught me per batch. It's just, you can't make a bigger batch. It just doesn't work. So
you have more than one person doing it. Yeah.
Yeah. Like if you had four people and each one of them made one batch, then you could do it. And I think that if I had like a serious restaurant, that's what I'd have to do. But I understand that at Robichon, it's probably producible in volume in a way that yours was not, but it was very good, but you've had better.
That's awesome to hear. I think it was on Eater. I mean,
no disrespect. Like, the Robichon potato puree is justly famous, but the thing is, we'd all read that book. when we were developing other potato puree techniques, you know?
Yeah.
Like if I've been able to see farther, it's because I was standing on the shoulders of giants. Like
Pierre Garnier's restaurant was fucking disappointing, man.
Really?
It was real disappointing. Yeah, it was completely forgettable. It was completely forgettable, man. Like I remember the charger plate being fucking dope. It was like this just the plate itself. It looked like it was like matte porcelain, so it was kind of rough to the feel, but it looked like it was shattered. It was just a beautiful plate. Like the food itself, man, that plate was fucking cool. And like the fucking, like the bill, god damn, I don't even remember what it was, but it was a lot.
That's rough.
Yeah. Skydiving though. Have you ever been skydiving?
No. I don't know if I'm a skydiver.
Really?
I might.
Hands down, one of the most, that is the number one most exhilarating experience of my entire life. And I will cherish it forever. It was unreal. I did it. I like to think that I would do it again and again and again and again, but like it's nerve-wracking.
I can imagine. I mean, it's also expensive as hell, right?
Yeah. Crazy expensive. Yeah. And it's only lasts like a minute.
I don't know if that's for me. I like experiences as much as the next guy. Never really wanted to do it. Never looked at people doing it and thought, I got to do that.
You ever seen Point Break?
Yeah, I've seen Point Break.
How could you not want to go skydiving after seeing Point Break? I don't want to skydive ever since that movie came out, man. That was so fucking cool. Dude, but like, honestly, the serious part where it was the paperwork was fucking terrifying. The amount of times that it says, sign here, understanding that you could die. There's like the watermark behind everything. It says, you might die. You know, list your next of kin for us to call. All this kind of shit. And it wasn't fucking around. It was like legal shit. And then you get on the plane and you're strapped to this fucking psychopath that does this like 10 times a day. And they all just fuck with everyone the whole way up. They're like, if you see me floating in front of you, don't worry, I have a parachute. Like shit like that. Like, and then when it came down to like time to go, it was all business. They fucking strap you in like a rock. They like, you know, this is what's going to happen. This is what you're going to do. Tuck your feet under the plane. I sat like on the plane with my feet outside of the plane and tucked under the plane. And there's no like 1, 2, 3, go. It's just like, whoop, you just go. And I remember seeing the plane, you know, there's like a plane like this. It's this close to you and it just shrinks down to nothing because you're falling so fast. And like the wind is coming at you so hard. Like I felt the wind blowing through my nose, down my throat. I could feel the wind in my stomach.
Wow.
And I remember looking down and seeing like the Hoover Dam look like a fucking toothpick. It looked like somebody dropped a few like green beans on the ground, like green shaped kidney beans. That was a golf course. And you're just like, holy shit. And you're like, you just let go. You're like, if I'm going to fucking die, like there's no way around it. Like I'm dying. But I, you know, you're just like, you're just freaking out. And then the fucking shoot goes and you're like, I'm gonna live. And then you have like a couple minutes of like this serene, like I'm fucking, like I just flew through the sky like a bird. And then you land, and the instant I landed and stood up, all I wanted to do was just go back on the plane and do it again. It was the most incredible, like never had that much adrenaline in my life. This has nothing to do with food, I'm sorry.
Well, no, it's fine. It's still interesting. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed this, but we do meander off topic from time to time.
Every now and then, we had a topic to talk about that we haven't even touched on at all yet.
And I'm pivoting to it right now.
All right.
So we were talking about Bobby Flay, and one of the things that Bobby Flay did that I liked, it really, really made me happy, was it was on the Food Network. I don't remember what show, but he was doing sort of a Q&A with the public. And they were sort of chatting with him. And there was a woman who said, you know, Bobby, it's really great to be here. I have a couple of your cookbooks and I use them all the time. And he goes, oh, cool. Do the recipes work? And that cracked me up because I feel like if I wrote a cookbook, that would be the constant fear. So what I wanted to throw it open to you was, yeah, Let's spend a couple of minutes talking about what we do or don't want to see in cookbooks. Like what are some red flags? What are some gold stars? Like what makes a good cookbook for you? Is there anything that if you see it, you're like, yes, this is the book for me? And anything that you're frustrated that more cookbooks don't do? Or anything where if you see it, you're like, this cookbook is maybe not what I thought it was? Because I know we spend a lot of time talking about cookbooks.
Don't work is a fucking huge red, like, I fucking can't stand that. Like, I remember buying Kiko da Costa's first book, and this is back when molecular gastronomy was like really, you know, taking hold and all that kind of stuff. But I'm trying to remember what kind of bubbly thing it was. I think it was using like a fish pump and aloe vera to, you know, to make those like huge bubbles. Gram for gram, did everything exactly right. Not one fucking thing worked. I hate that.
Yeah, okay. I can see that. I agree. It's frustrating when recipes don't work. However, I actually wrote a blog post on this recently, and I'm not going to spend much time on it. If you're interested, you can look up the blog post where I talk about how to tell, you know, how precise, how much you should trust a cookbook. But I think there's a place for cookbooks where the recipes don't work perfectly.
Yeah.
And it depends on the type of cookbook. Like, if a cookbook is doing progressive cuisine and it's hyper-technical and the recipes don't work, that is a huge problem.
Yeah.
That is a big, big issue, because the reason you buy a book like that is to mine it for techniques and ratios. And yeah. That's one of the reasons I love the Alinea cookbook, is because it's been well-tested. Everything I've ever tried out of there has pretty much worked.
Yeah, and it has.
I certainly haven't done
it. You're talking about the first one, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't done any whole dishes out of there because Jesus Christ, no. But
give them credit too, there are some things, some recipes in there that are like, make more than you need because not every single one will work. I remember like they were doing like raisinate, like they remember spherification with the sodium alkylate and sodium citrate and all that kind of stuff. They like raisinated some of them and they're like, make way more than you need. Like, some of these are going to pop and not work.
Which, by the way, you say that is exactly what working for Grant Atkins is like. Like, if you need 40 orders, you have to make 90 because you're going to have a less than 50% success rate. Like, that is just what it's like to work for that guy. And the reason is because he so rarely sticks around to work the kinks out. Like, once the dish has been successful and been realized on the menu, at least this is how his mind worked in the beginning, he didn't want to stick with it too long. He'd file it for later and then do something different. So we were always off balance. We were always innovating. And that's a hell of a way to work. I could never do that. At some point, I want to fall back on things I know work. Like, I like old recipes, man. Have you ever had a petit vivier?
Petit vivier?
Yeah.
Fuck yeah.
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 No improvement necessary. Pate inside a pate pie inside brioche dough brushed with egg yolk. It's awesome. I don't need to make one a new way. I need to make one an old way. If I go into a restaurant and I see they have a petit vivier on the menu, I'm so stoked.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's like, I don't need something new. Sometimes something old is perfect.
That's like, some foods, some recipes have like that perfection problem, like mussels. You know, moule meunière is like one of the most perfect things you can fucking make.
Yeah.
You know, mussels, wine, garlic, butter, salt, parsley. Like,
yeah, you know, serve with a loaf of bread, a cone of French fries, and some aioli.
And done a beer. Yeah. You're fucking good.
Bottle of Muscadet.
Yeah.
It cost you like €3.50 because Muscadet is almost as cheap as water in France. Hell yeah. The hyper technical recipes that don't work are a big, big issue. But I have less of a problem with, there's so many cookbooks where you just know you can't trust the recipes. And that's not always a bad thing. Like, sometimes like those culinary cookbooks, you remember those? Those are great. They're a great series. They're super educational. Beautiful. You take one look at the recipe and you're like, well, that's suspect, because it's like, you know, they give you 8 ingredients and then like 40 words on what to do with the ingredients. I can't tell you how to make toast in 40 words.
Well, like, and sometimes they show the picture of you, the finished dish, and you're like, that's not in there. That's not in there. You know?
So, but if a book has other stuff to offer, culinary is not about recipes, it's about culinary knowledge. It's about, like, if you get a copy of Culinaria, for instance, in culture, France, and you read it cover to cover, you will understand the regional cooking of France better than you would have before you picked it up. And so I think those books are great for professionals. If you look at the recipe, you're like, okay, well, I'm not going to follow the recipe at all, because it clearly is not going to work, but I'm going to get a general idea of what's in there. Like, there are cookbooks that are great for inspiration. Another one, how about My Beloved Magastronomy?
Yeah, dude. Yeah.
I can't cook out of, no one can cook out of that book.
It's a beautiful book though, man.
You have to be 150th Don Black Belt in French cuisine to cook out of that book. Like,
you know, Patricia Wells, she's got a great, a few great books on French cuisine.
Her books are really good. Yeah. Really good. I put her up there with Paula Wolfert, just for in terms sure. of like women whose names start with W that write really good cookbooks on Mediterranean and French cuisine.
Yeah.
Or like another time is when you're looking at an old cookbook. Now, Magastronomy is an example, but like also like Richard Olney or Elizabeth David, like you go through and read one of their books. Those recipes are highly suspect. Yeah. And they're also filled with like ingredients like a wine glass of whatever, like a wine glass.
Yeah.
Day. Like, is that 4 ounces? Is that 8 ounces? There's lots of different types of wine glasses,
like,
lady.
Like, we should talk about like some of the staples, like Joy of Cooking. There is nothing suspect. There's nothing wrong in the Joy Cooking books. I've got some of like the earlier editions where like they show you how to break down a squirrel and shit like that. I mean, like,
yeah, Joy of Cooking, Better Homes and Gardens, those cookbooks work really well. Those are great for a beginner because you don't need to like divine which recipes are going to work and which ones aren't. I made the observation in my blog post that it's funny. The cookbooks where the recipes tend to work the most consistently are at the very top of the pile, like the Alinea and French Laundry books, and then at the very most basic side of things, the Better Homes and Gardens, Joy of Cooking, Fanny Farmer, like those two bookends are where the absolute most correct recipes are. And everywhere in the middle is kind of like, all over the place. But I think if you have a cookbook that has other stuff to bring to the table, that's valuable. I also think that the higher a level of a chef that you are, the less you need recipes that work. Like if you have a cookbook and it's just good for inspiration, you're just like, well, that looks awesome. That's a combination I wouldn't have thought of. And then you read the ratio and you're like, every once in a while you have that little voice where you're like, I know that's wrong. I know that's not going to work out, but I know how to make that work. So I'll just do that instead. Like,
but it does happen every now and then. I've got just a basic pie shell recipe that I need to send you. You look at it and you're like, there is no way that fat content and like this recipe would work. Like if I read that recipe in a cookbook, I would be sitting here just like we're talking like right now and being like, yeah, that's suspect. It is gold mine. I'll send it to you.
Yeah, you send it to me. I'll send you my new favorite pie crust recipe because I have a new favorite pie crust recipe.
Really?
The one from Edna Lewis and Scott Peacock's book.
Great book. I know exactly what you're talking about.
The Gift of Country Cooking. That pie crust is the bomb. So yeah, send me yours. I'll send you mine. Well, let's make some pies, man.
Dude, we should make some pies, dude. This pie shell, honestly, like for quiche, I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank. Shortbread is a ace up the sleeve for like a straight up quiche Lorraine. Like shortbread, like a more savory shortbread, like it has like this little sweetness to it. But like this pie shell recipe, I'm gonna send you right now.
Can I share it on the blog?
Figure this out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is so fucking good, and it works with so many different things, like tarts, that kind of thing. But it also works really good with like sweet things too. It's like just one of these like good. Why does it say failed? I sent it.
While you're figuring that out, what I really liked about the Lewis and Peacock pie crust recipe. It was a mixture of butter and lard, but apart from that, the ingredients were pretty straightforward. It was like butter, lard, flour, pinch of salt, that's it. But it was what they had you do, where first you cut it all together, and then you worked it into like a block, and then like folded the block over a couple of times, and then pulled an eighth of the block away and smashed it flat onto the counter. I have marble counters now, so that actually worked really well without it like smearing everywhere.
Interesting.
And then gathered it up, and then you pick the next eighth out, smash it flat, and then like pile that on top, and then you break it into eight pieces, and it's one pie's worth, or maybe probably two, probably a double crust pie's worth. This was a big freeform tart, but you break off an eighth of the batter, smash it flat, and then sort of add it in, and then you bring it all back together and you roll it out. And something about smashing it flat, I think, created like thin leaves of fat in the dough, it wasn't the ingredients, it was how they had you put it together. And yeah, it made just a really great flaky pie crust. And then having lard and butter together was, from a flavor standpoint, just absolutely flawless.
Flavor standpoint, but also just like texture standpoint. Like butter has like more moisture content to it, right, than lard. Well,
I mean, lard has no moisture content at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
So but if you used all lard, I bet that it ended up being lard has a porky flavor. Like it's subtle, but it's there.
But it also has like a greasy texture, like, you know, when you eat it and everything. Butter ends up having like more of a flakier, cleaner texture.
Yeah, I think the butter and lard combo is clutch. But really, it was the breaking it into pieces and smashing them flat on the counter that really seemed that was the thing.
That sounds so familiar. I can't remember if I've ever made that before or read that before.
That was the thing I'd never done. So I'll put up a little pie crust recipe comparison on the blog hotdogscaviar.blogspot.com.
I'm making it, dude.
You're absolutely right. Like when a recipe, occasionally you'll find a book that has a recipe that's nuts. And actually, that's part of my new. And then the recipe works, and your mind is blown. That's part of my process for whenever I like do a cookbook. If there's a recipe that jumps out as like that's not going to work, I'll try it. And then if it works, I know to pay attention to the little things in the recipe that I think are wrong. You know what I mean? If I tried the crazy one and the crazy one manages to nail it, then I'll be like, if he tells me to do something counterintuitive, I'll actually do it. Whereas if I try the recipe that seems crazy and it turns out that my instincts were correct and the recipe sucks, then I'll know to trust my instincts as I go. So from now on, whenever I review a cookbook for the blog, I've got a 5-point precision index where like a 5 out of 5 is like a French Laundry cookbook. These recipes will work, or a Joy of Cooking cookbook. And then a 4 out of 5 would be like, you know, there's going to be a few quibbles, but for the most part, this is a solid piece of work. And I think most good cookbooks fit that 4. There's very few 5s out there. And then a 3 out of 5, that's average, which means that like most cookbooks, like the Edna Lewis and Scott Peacock cookbook, there's a few things in here that are just wacky. Don't worry about that. Trust your instincts. Change what looks like it might need changing and be ready to adjust on the fly. And then a 2 out of 5 is like, this is not a precise cookbook. Maybe use the recipes for inspiration, but don't worry too much about the technical details. And then a 1 out of 5 is like, good fucking luck. Either the cookbook is incredibly badly written.
Yeah, you did Costa, 1 out of 5 for sure.
It's really old, like Magastronomy, 1 out of 5. And that's one of the best books ever written. So that's what.
Yeah, but that one's more like take ye a handful of butter and a flagon of wine and stir it together, you know.
Add 400 whole fresh black truffles.
Yeah. one of my more recent books that I have really been enjoying. I haven't made anything out of it, but nothing seems suspect because it's so straight up, is Lennox Hassey's what's it called? Is it it's about cooking over fire, I think it's called. It's the dude they just had a whole Netflix thing about him, but he cooks everything over open fire. He goes through, I mean, there's like 50 different types of wood, and he talks about different hardness and smoke levels and like suggestions of like different types of food to use with different types of wood. Like imagine if you had 50 different burners on your stove and you had like a dinner to do and you had like 50 different ingredients, like which burner would you put on which stove?
I mean, that's awesome.
But like, and you know, just like a lot of the recipes are like, you know, like vegetables cooked over embers with like, you know, like a little bit of oil and salt, but solid as a rock cookbook. Did you get St. Peter Pato yet?
Yeah.
You like it?
I've thumbed through it and it looks absolutely rad. By the way, the book you were talking about, right? I got the title real quick. It's Finding Fire. By Lennox Hassey. Fire. Yeah. Thank so you. I'll put a link to that up on the blog. St. Peter Pato's book is really, really great. I haven't read it. I'm currently reading something listed like it, that I had in the queue beforehand. I'd rather read St. Peter Pato, but this other one is just kind of I've been putting it off. St. Peter Pato is in the queue immediately. It looks so good. I cannot wait to go like to go. And when I go through and read it, I'm just going to be thinking about what I have at my local fish market, the fish market yep. that I like. Shout out to Mount Pleasant Seafood. You guys are awesome. Keep on keep on saving me weird bycatch. it's going to be thinking about what they have available and then just try things out of that book based on what I can get at Mount Pleasant Seafood.
Try age your fish, man. It does something really cool.
They usually have meaty fish. They usually have wahoo or sword. So those like we talked last time, that seemed like the kind of thing that are good to dry age.
Yeah.
But I like what you're saying about the finding fire. Like it's, you know, it seems like the recipes will work because they're so elemental. Like, you know, a recipe is going to
elemental.
You know what? A recipe is going to work when there's not much to it. Like for consider. Okay. How about the ultimate example? How about the example for how to eat radishes in Nose to Tail? Where he's like, get the radishes, put some cold butter on the radishes, and then sprinkle them with sea salt and eat them.
Yeah.
I have tried that recipe and it works perfectly. That's where it's at. That's the ultimate five out of five.
You recommended a Chinese cookbook. You recommended a few different books of Chinese cuisine, and I got every single one. So I'm trying to remember which one I read it from. But it was one of the most simple things I've ever seen in my life. But like you just take radishes, smash like just to like you're cracking an egg, but like smash a radish with a side of a cleaver, salt, let it sit for like a couple hours, pour off all the juice, add chili oil or chili crisp, and just eat.
Sounds delicious.
Fuck, it's like one of the, oh my god, like I could eat piles of radishes that way.
It's kind of the same recipe. It's the formula of radish, fat, salt.
Exactly.
Yeah, so
but not every addition to chili, so there's like a little bit, so it's like peppery radish and peppery chili, you know, and spicy that's cool chili
because like radish heat hits your palate at a different place than like different. Chili heat, so like you get the first up your nose burst of like radishy heat and then the sort of back of the throat burn of chili heat.
Like that cleansing wasabi burn, and then at the same time like that spicy chili burn.
That's super cool.
Fucking good, man.
So we've talked about recipes that work and recipes that don't work, and the value of that. Is there anything else that you really like or dislike seeing in a cookbook?
I'll try and summarize it a little bit. I love cookbooks that are beautiful. Like I think we talked about the Fat Duck book, you know, and I think you even said it was either you or Nate were saying like the Fat Duck cookbook is beautiful if you have it. You'll flip through it, enjoy it, you put it on the shelf, and it's just something that you have, and it's expensive. But like the Wizard book, I when we talked about it, I completely forgot. I've seen that book. It's beautiful. I've never made anything out of it. It's a little inspiring, but like some books are insanely valuable, insanely beautiful, but not as functional as what a cookbook should be. Sometimes I think there should be another name for the genre, like, you know, split the genre up into like cookbook or art cookbook, you know, something like that.
I know
Michelle Roth kind of teeters on the edge of that.
I was going to drop that name, but I was going to put a question mark at the end. I was going to go Michelle Roth.
Yeah. It teeters like it's a beautiful, when I Michelle Roth book, if any of your listeners have never seen it, go if you can find it, get it. If someone has it, borrow it. Like it's beautiful, just the way it's laid out, the picture of the dish, the image actually spreads out over across both pages, and the recipe or the words are written on the other page. The gargoyle is by far one of the greatest dishes ever created by a human fucking being, and the recipe out of the book works. Like I haven't cooked that book from page to page, but there is a lot of stuff in that book that I have made that I still use to this day. Like the Michelle Braun neutral tweel. Do you remember that? It was just like egg white butter flour. And it's just like soft batter. You spread out, sprinkle with whatever spice, salt, nut, whatever, dried fruit, anything you want, bake. And it comes out in this beautiful tweel. There's functionality to it, but it is an art piece. So that one, I would say like kind of teeters. I guess my point is like, you know, and to go back to the first book I mentioned, the Frikika da Costa's first book is a beautiful book. Does not fucking work. It's very inspiring, but like it's, you know.
I mean.
And I get, my nose gets turned up when someone says the name of a dish on their menu is razor clams gathered and cooked under the light of a full moon. Like, come on, man. Like,
yeah,
you're in the middle of a fucking, in the middle of a city.
That's one thing I really liked about Grant Atkins's menus was they were pretty minimalist in that department. No descriptors, just a list of ingredients. And I love that. I write my menu that way because
if someone tells me like, you have to go see this movie, this happens, then you go see that movie, you're expecting everything. But if you just say like razor clam, butter, garlic, lemon, you have an idea, but then like it could be this huge, extravagant, mind-blowing, interactive course. And like the more to it there is, the more blown away you're going to be.
Yeah. I mean, like it's the undersell, overdeliver. Now the interesting thing about the Bra Cookbook, it's kind of a special case because the thing about the Bra Cookbook, its functionality falls apart because so many of the dishes are not replicatable because you just can't get the ingredients.
You can't get ingredients. And I don't fault the book for it though.
I'm not talking about luxury ingredients either. I'm talking about like wild herbs. And the reason I know this is because I got the book in French. Because in English it was 350 bucks. In French, I got it for like 75 euros. So I don't speak French, but I read enough of it to be able to translate recipes if I go slow. I only know culinary French words. I don't know anything else. But the interesting thing is that there would be an ingredient that I wouldn't know. And I would look it up online, and the French to English dictionaries don't usually get that in depth with like ingredients. So I would have to be like, I have no idea what this word means. What I learned was that if I saw an ingredient I didn't know, look it up on French Wikipedia, and it would be an herb or a flower, and then copy paste the Latin name of the herb or the flower and put that in English Wikipedia, and that would bring up its English language name. And none of them were, like, a lot of them weren't listed as food ingredients at all. Like, people had never thought of eating this. So with Bra, it's less about, you know, getting inside his head and learning his techniques, although there are some good techniques in the book, but more about just seeing what he's all about. And there's, I mean, I feel like the Gagnère books are kind of like that. In the sense that they don't always, you know, work all that well. It's interesting, the French chefs that give you, you know, exactly how to do their stuff, like Michel Richard, and then the French chefs that just give you hints, like Gagnère, and then the guys that are somewhere in the middle. Like, I feel like most of Alain Ducasse's books are somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I can see like Marc Vérat being kind of in the middle in a weird way. Like, he does like a lot of, you know, I haven't really looked at what he's doing recently, but like, he used to do like a lot of very modernist stuff, but he did it like in a very rural setting with rural ideas, you know, like.
I just remember his headshot looked like Gandalf.
Marc Vérat?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, he fucking shot a gun in the kitchen once.
That doesn't surprise me. He is the Michelin starred version of a crazy hillbilly.
Yeah, he's fucking nuts. I'm never eating his food, so I don't want to say anything one way or the other, but it's been very interesting to read and watch. You know, he definitely has an artistic approach to it.
But I absolutely see what you're saying.
And Michel Bra, I wonder if Sebastian's gonna do a book. The Michel Bra cookbook is a fucking icon. Michel Bra's restaurant is a fucking icon. Sebastian's been running it for a long fucking time, and he has nowhere to go but down. I feel like I don't know the guy, but I feel the pressure just reading about it. Like, I remember there was some either documentary or something that was talking, you know, like interviewing Sebastian, and you know, I think they were opening the restaurant in Japan at the time or something like that. And you know, he's like if anything goes wrong, it's because I'm running it now. If anything goes right, it's because my father made it that way, you know. And Sebastian Bra is an extremely talented chef, and I think he's carrying on his father's name perfectly. I think his albatross is that his dad had such a name that it's kind of like making it harder for him anyway.
Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe he'll rise to the occasion, or maybe he'll do his own thing. Maybe he'll spread his wings. It's hard to speculate. But I absolutely do see your point on books that are just more visual than anything else, and how like that's, you know, that's something that, on the other hand, one thing I like in cookbooks, I like a lot of images. Like, I love the Fergus Henderson cookbooks, but some photos would be nice, or some more photos that are in there. And I'm not knocking them. Those are some of my favorite books, but, you know, they're like, there's just, you know, I like my ideal. If there's an image, at least one image per recipe, that's perfect. I know that's also a lot of money.
Like, I know it's a lot of money, but like, I feel that's necessary.
Especially in fine dining, especially in a fine dining restaurant, like a fine dining menu, because there's the visual aspect of the dish is such a big part of it.
And if I'm spending like $75 and up on a cookbook, I expect to see some beautiful photography.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of it.
And I think, you know, an image per recipe for a completed dish is good. And also images help so much for process. Like, how many times have you been reading a recipe? Like, I'm trying to think of something like something that's easy to see someone do, but without a picture. Would like, imagine making a paper coronet for piping chocolate, like a picture, three pictures, and you can be like, oh, that's how you do it, just like that. But if you try,
you wrote it out, you're not gonna be
a whole page of text, and the people are gonna be making paper dolls and making paper snowflakes, and that, like, the thing is, paper cone's a bad example because
it's a good example. It's a perfect example because, I mean, that's like in its basest form. Like, if you start talking about like how to temper chocolate, you can write about it until you're fucking blue in the face. Think about our fucking perfect gnocchi recipe. If I just told you it was like, you know, potatoes, egg yolk, flour, and starch, you know, like, and then just wrote it all out. Like, unless you see it and feel it, like, you're never gonna be able to do it right.
Yeah, and the thing is, there's no substitute for feeling. I mean, that's something cookbooks can't do. But I think photos for complex processes are a really nice thing. I also get that every time you put a photo in a cookbook, you add the cost of that cookbook. I get that. And sometimes it's just not feasible. But I like to see a lot of images. A lot of images really help. One thing I don't like to see, I liked the Alain Passard vegetable book.
Very good book.
And you want to talk about like recipe that I didn't think was going to work. The asparagus cooked in brown butter for an hour and a half.
Told me about that.
It was in one of our stupid.
Yeah. Apparently it was fucking awesome.
It worked really, really well. And I was like, all right, man, I trust you. Whatever other fool thing you tell me to do, that's great.
I have never tried that. I remember you telling about it, and I might have read about it. I don't know, but I was like, what?
But in that cookbook, instead of photos, there was a collage. Alain Passard did like a construction paper collage for every dish. Like, he made art for every dish. And I'm like, that's all well and good, but some of these things really needed a photo. Like, it's a, like, cut a pineapple into boat shapes or something like that. Or cut a pineapple into pyramids. I'm like, I don't know how to cut a pineapple into pyramids. There's nothing about the shape of a pineapple that suggests pyramid to me. I don't know what you want. And all you had to do was put down the scissors and construction paper and take a fucking photo and put it in the book, and that book would have been better. Like, the lack of images hurt that book, and I liked that book, but that was a thing. Like, that's, give me pictures, man. Like, I'm not saying I need them to stay interested. I'm saying I need them because sometimes, imagine trying to cook out of the Alinea book without pictures.
Yeah, fuck, yeah.
Impossible, impossible. But also, sometimes a photo gives you the inspiration. Like, haven't you cracked open, like, a French Laundry, a Thomas Keller book, and just taken a look at a dish and thought, that looks so good, I gotta make that?
Yeah, so Lennox Hasse used to work at Ixabari in Spain, and I'm drawing a blank on the name of the chef there, but like, he's the kind of like the, like, I don't want to say OG because people cook it over fire for fucking 250,000 years, but like, everything cooked over charcoal. But like, one of his like signature dishes is glass eels cooked over charcoal, and apparently it's like, I've never had it. Apparently it's like fucking transcendently good.
Are those little finger eel things? Those eels look like spaghetti.
It looks like spaghetti, but a little eels, and you cook them alive, and just like nothing but like a little bit of salt, and that's it, and a little olive oil.
I don't think I knew their English language name. I've never heard them called glass eels.
Glass eels, there's other names for it. But
anguillettes is usually what I hear them called, just because I think in French when it comes to like high end culinary sometimes. But okay, glass eels, gotcha, cool.
Yeah, the imagery throughout that entire book like is stunningly good. Stunningly good. And like, if you've never heard of like little baby glass eels that looks like a bowl of spaghetti, that might sound revolting, but like knowing how good eel is cooked over open fire, knowing how what charcoal smoke does to food, and seeing an image with like smoky and like the eels getting cooked over coals, like it changes. It's different.
Yeah, so it's images important. Images are super important. Images are super important. And you know, once again, there are books that are favorites of mine with no images or almost no images, and the Nose to Tail books really shine as far as a good example of that. And then some books, like one of my favorite books is Sausage and Meat Curing Recipes by Ritek Kutas. And it's just a book of industrial sausage recipes. It's got some photos in it, but you don't need a photo of every individual sausage ratio. Like, they're just like, you know, here's a 10-pound batch, here's a 25-pound batch. Here's how much Bactoferm, here's how much dextrose. Like, they're industrial recipes. It's a fantastic book for a pretty good price. Really good sausage recipes you don't need a lot of images. Some books don't need images, but fine dining books really need images, and books that are geared towards beginners really need images. Like, yeah. The Joy of Cooking is great, but have you ever read like one of those Jacques Pepin technique books with all the photos in it?
Mm-hmm.
Those are so helpful for a beginner.
Yeah,
I mean, I think guys like us, you and I have probably graduated past where that's really like a thing that we need, but man, can you imagine if you had one of those when you were 18?
Yeah.
How much like just guesswork that would cut out?
The Bo Freiberg pastry book, man. I mean, that's a great example too.
Well, and that's actually, as far as that is a school textbook, am I right? Like, they use that at schools.
They should.
He's a teacher. It looks like a school textbook. It costs $75 and weighs 60 goddamn pounds.
Yeah, it should be if it's not.
All right, well, you're looking tired, and I've yawned a couple of times. So
yeah, I'm done.
I have one more thing that I wanted to bring up with, and the reason I brought it up is because I encountered it a couple of times in the last couple of days. One more thing that bugs me about cookbooks is I think the author of a cookbook has a certain duty to the safety of the person using it. And I've seen a couple of cookbooks kind of fail in that department in the last couple of days.
In what way?
Well,
yes, I agree, but in what way?
Well, in one way, I just finished reviewing The Gift of Southern Cooking by Peacock and Lewis. I liked it. It was a flawed but very fun book. Their fried chicken recipe was absolutely bananas.
Really?
We've been through this, I thought. It was, they're just...
Cliff's That's notes. Right.
Cliff Notes versions of the method, 12 hours in brine, then 12 hours in buttermilk, then 12 hours air drying on a rack in the refrigerator, then dredge, and then you make a cooking fat where you take lard and toast country ham scraps in the lard to flavor it like with country ham, and then fold in butter and let it cook low and slow until the butter kind of like the solids toast out, and then skim the solids, and then so you have that country ham and toasted butter flavored lard, and then you fry the chicken in that, and it rules.
God damn, that sounds good. No, you didn't tell me about that.
Okay, well, I should have. I told you. Yeah, it might have been, and I'm sure maybe the people at home have heard this already or not. Maybe they haven't, but yeah, it was one of the best fried chickens I've ever made. It was a pain in the ass. It took 3 days, and it ruled. It was really, really good. There was a recipe for a gravy to go with it, and the gravy was unnecessary. Like, the gravy sat on the side, and Dee and I just ate the chicken, and then later on we were like, the gravy's good, but whatever.
Who cares?
Like, the chicken didn't need sauce. It was moist and flavorful. It was incredibly good. But that same
12 hours in brine, 12 hours in buttermilk, 12 hours drying. No shit.
Yeah. It wasn't a super strong brine either. It wasn't like a Henderson level brine. I think 12 hours in brine would take a cut up bone in chicken and make it like inedibly salty. But if you can get the book for less than $10, you should, and you probably can. That recipe alone worth the price.
What's the name of it?
The Gift of Southern Cooking by Edna Lewis and Scott Peacock. It's not a perfect book, but there's a lot going for it. Read the review. It's up on hotdogsandcaviar.blogspot.com. Tarvi, you should read the review too. It's right there. But the safety issues. First off, there was a recipe for pan-fried soft-shell crabs. And I love pan-fried soft-shell crabs, but if you were telling someone were telling someone that had never pan-fried a soft-shell crab before, what would you tell them apart from the recipe and what goes in it?
stand back, fire in the hole, cover that pan with a screen. Yeah.
Yeah. Soft shell crabs are dangerous. And like deep frying them is okay because you're usually standing clear of the deep fryer because it's like spitting everywhere. Soft shell crabs have pockets of moisture in them and you can't get them all. If you're pan frying a soft shell crab, that oil is hot, hotter than a deep fryer. And then when one of those pockets explodes, it shoots oil out. Gets on your floor, gets in your eyes, can cause second degree burns on your face. Like, it's no joke.
Oh, weird. Are you being sympathetic to that now all of a sudden?
Tarver, no one cares.
Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yes, I remember what you're talking about. Warrior,
would you say?
I didn't. You didn't seem like you wanted to go to the hospital. I was trying to take your back. I have apologized on multiple occasions. Also, I thought Cherie was going to kill me. Anyway, but also beyond that, they can just ruin you. Like, they can ruin your upholstery. I mean, like, cover it with a splatter screen because otherwise you're going to have grease flying everywhere. Dangerous hot grease. And I think that just to give a recipe for soft shell crabs and not say, by the way, use a splatter screen is irresponsible. You're leaving out an important step.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Have you ever made concha?
No, like
the Peruvian concha.
I've never worked with it.
It's basically like Peruvian corn nuts in a way, but like same thing. Like you would like basically like we would use a deep fryer to like do it, you know, just because, you know, we're doing it like in larger batches. But like anytime you ever see a recipe for concha, it's like get a pan, like it's pan frying. And you put these like, you know, almost hominy like corn kernels in like ripping hot oil, and it's like pow 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 pow. Like if you don't have a splash screen, you're fucked. Your house, your face, your clothes are all fucked.
Just a huge omission. Or then a few pages later in the dessert section, they were talking about how to make peanut brittle, and there was no warning about how dangerous sugar cooked to caramel is. And like, you can't make peanut brittle without caramelizing sugar. And if somebody just wasn't thinking and dropped a pan of hot caramel on like their 5-year-old or their dog or their foot, like there's a whole bunch of different ways that could go wrong. And I just thought it was kind of irresponsible to not say anything. And then in the book that I was reading today, there was a section on flavored oils. And the author was just like, you know, use any kind of flavored oil you like. All you got to do is just take your favorite aromat, like a garlic or spring onion or herbs, cover it with your favorite oil, put it in a bottle with a cork, and it'll keep for a year. And that's not true.
That's not true at all.
That's a botulism hazard.
Huge.
Like you put garlic is low acid. And if you cover it in oil, that's low acid, room temperature, anaerobic. That is exactly where botulism likes to hang out. So if your garlic has a little bit of cooties on it, those cooties wouldn't matter.
I remember like being a kid making like oils like that, like, oh, and they look so beautiful in the bottle. You put like thyme and garlic in the bottle and pour oil in there. And like, you wait a month. Like you see like mold inside, like the bubbles that are like the bubbles that are around the herbs, like the around the garlic, you see mold growing everywhere. Like that's a year. That's fucked up.
Yeah. And it didn't say anything about refrigerating them. It just said talk, and I'm like, that's not responsible. That's not true. Like, are you probably going to get botulism? No, you're probably not going to get botulism. But I think that just telling people that all you need to do is drop garlic in there and it'll hold for a year, like, if you took the garlic and put it in oil, heated the oil up to a simmer, held it there for a couple minutes, and then dropped it back down in temperature and kept it in the refrigerator, you've got something much, much safer.
There's way better ways to make
If you just drop garlic in and then just let it hang out on your counter, you're playing with fire. And this book came out in 2009. If it came out in 1950, I would be a little more forgiving, but it came out in 2009. And I think at some point the author of a cookbook has a duty to help the people that work out of the cookbook not injure or kill themselves or their family. And I was really disappointed by the lack of warning, really. The garlic here.
Is there any type of? I mean, there's like. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No.
Is there regulation? Like, you know, a health department comes in your kitchen to make sure you're not killing people. Is there some sort of regulation when you write a cookbook? I mean, if I were to say, chicken tart. If I were to make a cookbook with chicken tartare.
Is that on you? That's an interesting question.
Is there some sort of like, you know? Is it on the publisher? Is it on the writer? Somebody's going to get sick if you eat chicken tartare, you know, especially with like American
chicken. Factory farm chicken that stands in its own shit for like 8 months at a time from its birth to its death. Yeah, no, that's a great question, and I'd love to know the answer. If anyone knows the answer, let us know, and maybe I'll do a little research. What I'm going to do is spend 5 minutes on the internet seeing if I can figure it out while I'm typing up the notes for this podcast episode. But that's a great question.
Yeah, I mean, what kind of moron would make chicken tartare? But like, you know, I mean, someone buys. I mean, I've heard of people suing McDonald's because the coffee was too hot and winning. You know, I wonder where where that kind of. Because you're right, like pan frying soft shell crabs is fucking dangerous. And if you got like other burners going on, you know, like, and maybe you got another. I wonder where that goes.
Or what happens if, like, I don't know. I'm just thinking of other accidents that can happen at a kitchen if you don't know what you're doing. Like, what if somebody was trying to deep fry in too small a pot, and the cookbook didn't have good instructions for deep frying? It just had incomplete instructions for deep frying. And they put whatever they're deep frying in the pot, and the oil goes over the side and hits the open flame and ignites and burns their house down. Whose fault is that? Like, that could happen.
So here's the flip side of that. Like, just hypothetically, this conversation makes it all the way to the FDA. And the FDA says, hold on a second. Hot dogs and caviar was right. We need to fucking look into how cookbooks are being written. And fucking put some regulations on it. It goes through Congress, the House, the Senate, and ends up being this fucking screws so tight that, like, you know, because the health department wants you to cook chicken to like 165, 168 degrees.
Yeah.
Fahrenheit. You know, you make it fucking dry as a fucking bone.
You make an interesting and dark point.
You know what I mean?
Are we going to be the guys that ruin cookbooks for everyone?
Yeah, like the guy who ruined McDonald's fries. You ever hear that story?
No.
I mean, you know, McDonald's fries used to be made with beef fat.
Oh, yeah.
They used to be fried in tallow. And like, I've never had them, but apparently McDonald's fries were like what one of the things that made McDonald's fucking amazing, like as big as they are, because the fries were amazing. There was an extremely rich man. I'll have to find this information. You should Google it or something. But like, there's a very wealthy man, retired, hell-bent that anything with fat made you unhealthy and fat, found out that McDonald's was cooking french fries in beef fat, basically made it his life's fucking mission to stop them from frying fries in beef fat. Full page articles in every newspaper, TV show appearances, ads in magazines, lawsuits, unrelenting. I mean, his kids were pissed. They're like, you know, A, you're spending our entire inheritance on going after McDonald's, and B, like, this is fucking nuts. Long story short, McDonald's fucking caves. They come up with what is called either Formula 47 or Formula 42 or whatever it is. This fucking oil mixture that, like, never goes bad, somehow, like, evaporates and then sticks to every single fucking surface around the fryer. Got rid of the beef fat altogether, McDonald's, and then like
I'm willing to bet the replacement's full of trans fats. It is actually worse for
him. Oh, it's probably fucked up. And in the story, he sits down with McDonald's fries using the new Formula 47 fryer oil, wherever the fuck it is, and sits down and he goes, "Yeah, these aren't nearly as good as they used to be."
Yeah.
What the fuck? And like, I honestly like so long. I had like Henley was extremely hungry. I got some McDonald's for Henley and I was like, oh yeah, McDonald's fries. These things used to be cooked in beef fat. And I ate one. I was like, man, those things fucking suck. Whatever. Henley's loves them. Whatever. I was just thinking about it. I was like, why not fucking like that would be a huge, huge thing for McDonald's to do, to be like, even just like test run, market research. McDonald's brings back the beef fat fried fries. You know, I mean, like
vegetarians would freak out.
Yeah, I know. But they can eat the Formula 47 shit.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I'm not pushing for McDonald's. I don't eat fast food that much.
No, me either. I really don't.
I really don't.
Look and like I do, but I don't.
Having a child, like you just kind of, there's times where you just kinda have to.
You have a small child. Compromises occasionally must be made. But you make an interesting
point.
I don't think this is going to get to the FDA. I don't think we're going to be the guys that cause there to be the cookbook laws. I think what would cause that would be if there was a serious lawsuit and the plaintiff won. And a lot of times change isn't brought about by legislation. Change is brought about by money. So if somebody gets sick because they did something a cookbook said and then sues, then the publishers will all fix their own houses before the government gets involved.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So But what I think is that I'm not saying there should be regulation. I'm not saying there should be a governing body. I'm saying every publisher of recipes should just have someone run through and edit the book and just look for obvious safety issues and just put a few disclaimers, a few hints, a few warnings in. And then, you know, once they get their legal ass coverage in place, maybe it's going to take a cookbook publisher getting sued and losing. Maybe that's what it's going to take, is that somebody actually does, you know, kill their grandmother or something with like a bad, you know, botulism, garlic oil thing. And then there'll be a lawsuit, and then they'll win the lawsuit, and the publisher will have to pay out. And then every other publisher will be like, all right, as of now, we have a legal department who goes through every cookbook and looks for potential safety hazards. And, you know, they say you must put these warnings in. I would have, as a cookbook author, I would have no problem with that. If somebody wanted to say, if I was talking about serving raw beef, and they wanted to say, you have to say something about how you can't serve this to people with repressed immune systems. Or if I was talking about deep frying and they were like, you have to put, if you're going to put recipes on deep frying, we really need to just write a half a page on safe deep frying and just put that in there. Or safe cooking, or safe caramel, or safe soft shell crab frying. Like, just, I would have no problem if the legal department from my publisher came through and said, hey, you need to do these things to make sure people stay safe. I would rather that than having it on my conscience that someone lost an eye because they were like leaning in to check out the crab as it fried and got a face full of hot peanut oil. You know, like, that's,
dude, my last dishwasher, this dude from Peru named Justo, his left eye is like gray. Like, it's, he burnt, like a fryer, like spat into his eye, almost lost his eye completely. He can barely see out of it. He's scary as shit.
That can happen. That's a real thing. So I think that my closing point on what I look for in cookbooks is, I really get frustrated when cookbooks have obvious safety issues, just because these people paid money for your recipes. You have a duty to help them not kill themselves.
Yeah.
Agreed. And I wish that there was a little more oversight. It's frustrating when I see things like, just put garlic and oil, throw a cork in it, and it's good for a while.
It's not. It's really not.
We're going to call it a night because Sarver and I are both very tired because we are old. And he has a small child, which is slowly draining his bone marrow with her fangs.
She woke me up at 4, dude.
Oh, my God. That's awful. So, Speakeasy's going to play us out of here. Thanks for joining us tonight. Join us next week when we talk about something. I don't even know what. Food or like
I love you, Jesse.
Love you too, Charver. So thank you so much for joining us. This has been fantastic, and we'll see you all next time.
Watch out for those pan-fried soft shells.
Watch out for those pan-fried soft shells. Jesus Christ.
Come on, little baby. Keep your head up. Come on, come on, come on, little baby. My little darling, my little sister. Come on, baby, just